So turn again, please, to the passage we read, Proverbs chapter 1. And as I said, we shall be considering this evening verses 8 to 19. Now, I talked this morning about fractions, and I suppose another dirty word, if you're a teacher or a pupil at school, is the word curriculum. But really, the book of Proverbs is a curriculum. As I mentioned, I think, last Lord's Day evening, the book of Proverbs is essentially the teaching about living for God in this world, which godly parents are to deliver to their children. Now, it's not just that. If it were, then for many of us in the room this evening, the whole book would be irrelevant, perhaps. And we saw last Sunday evening that it does have a broader relevance and application. We saw how the writer to the Hebrews kind of broadens the scope of the word sons, which is such a frequent word in Proverbs, to include all Christians, all members of a Christian congregation. So it's not just a curriculum for literal children in the godly home, but it certainly is that before it's anything else. It may be more than that, but it's never less than that. That's what Solomon was primarily intending. And that's why then our text this evening in verse 8 begins, "Hear, my son, your father's instruction." And that kind of phraseology is very common throughout the book of Proverbs, precisely for this reason I've just expressed, that in its original intention, Proverbs is a curriculum for parents to deliver to their children. And so, taking that as our starting point then, I'd like to consider our passage this evening under three headings, noticing, first of all, the context of the father's instruction. The context of the father's instruction. So look then at verse 9, and you'll notice that in verse 9, we have two pictures of the father's instruction. Hear your father's instruction, we're told in verse 8. Although, by the way, notice interestingly that it's your mother's teaching as well, so this is teaching from both parents, but the emphasis does seem to be in Proverbs on the father's instruction. So, hear, my son, your father's instruction, and then, verse 9, for they are... dot, dot, dot. So, we're given in verse 9 two pictures of the father's instruction. And I suppose they're the kind of pictures that we could easily just kind of skip over. It just seems like flowery language and we don't really need to bother too much about verse 9. But actually, I think there is more to these two pictures than immediately meets the eye. Let's consider them in reverse order. So pendants, first of all. The father's instruction, if it's taken on board and heeded by you, my child, he's saying, it will be a pendant for your neck. Now, pendants in the ancient world were not merely ornamental. The pagan peoples in the nations around Israel, they would wear pendants with images of their gods on them. And the thinking was, the rationale was, that these pendants with an image of some god on them, they provided protection from danger. That was the thinking behind wearing these pendants. Now, in view of that, against that backdrop, you might think it's rather surprising that here this Israelite text, Proverbs 1:9, is endorsing this practice then, this superstitious practice of wearing a pendant around your neck for protection. But of course it's not endorsing that practice. It's saying the opposite, isn't it? It's saying, the father here is saying, look son, you don't need to bother about what you're wearing around your neck. That's irrelevant. All you need to bother about is taking on board my instruction, heeding it, putting it into practice, and that will be your protection from danger. that will serve for you what they think these silly necklaces do for them. That will truly be a pendant round your neck. That will truly provide protection. So that's the pendant. And then the other picture we have is the picture of a garland for your head. Now, as you may be aware, garlands then in the ancient world signified victory. The winner in a sporting or athletic contest would be given a garland for his or her head. And so this is saying to us then that the Father's instruction, the Father's godly instruction taken on board and heeded by the child, it will be for that child protection and victory. That's what these two pictures are saying to us. Which then raises the question, doesn't it? Well, protection from what? And victory over what? Well, you see, one of the great themes, I think, of Proverbs chapters 1 to 9 is this, that the father's instruction to his children in the godly Israelite home, the father's instruction doesn't take place in a vacuum. It doesn't take place in a context of kind of uncontested influence over his child or over his children. But rather, it takes place in a context where there are all sorts of other competing voices and worldviews being presented to the children. So, yes, in these chapters, you have the father's voice. Again and again, repeatedly, you have the father's voice teaching, instructing in chapters 1 to 9. You also have wisdom's voice. Those of you who have read Proverbs will know that, and we won't go in now into who wisdom is. You'll notice in the very next verse after our passage tonight, verse 20, we have wisdom, this person, it seems, speaking. As I say, we won't now go into who or what that is. Suffice to say that wisdom speaks with the same kind of instruction as the father in Proverbs. So you have the father's instruction going on. You have wisdom saying the same things. But then there are also other voices in these first nine chapters of Proverbs. Two in particular. As one of the commentators puts it, one of them offering easy money, the other one offering easy sex. There are these other two voices that we have in the first nine chapters of Proverbs. And that then is why the Father is saying at the outset here in verse 9 that if you take on board my teaching, it will give you protection and it will give you victory. Protection from these other voices, these other worldviews that will inevitably bombard you in this world. Victory over these other voices, these other worldviews that will inevitably bombard you in this world. These attractive offers, these enticements, these allurements that you will face repeatedly again and again and again. If you want to be protected from the danger of those allurements, if you want to triumph over them, then you need to take on board my instruction. That's the point. And perhaps then this evening, you're a young person. And perhaps you've had a privileged Christian upbringing. Years of instruction in the gospel and how to live in this world in the light of the gospel. And if so, you need to realize that all that instruction, it's not like the safety announcements that you get at the start of a ferry crossing which you kind of just listen to vaguely, hardly taking any notice at all, because you know that number one, they're just going through it to comply with legal requirements, and number two, the chances of it ever being relevant are fairly remote, and number three, if there was an incident, they would go through it all again anyway. And so you just listen very vaguely. This instruction that you've received throughout your Christian upbringing, it's not like that, because you are growing up in a world where every day there is a battle going on for your very soul. Offers of easy money, easy sex, 1,001 other perils just as real. And there's this battle going on every day. And so it's desperately important that you take on board and heed all that instruction that you've received over all those years. It will give you protection. It will give you victory. But then, as we've said already, it's applicable beyond just young people. All of us this evening, we all receive instruction, don't we, here, week by week. And again, we can just easily let it brush over us and not really pay all that much attention. But the fact is, we're going out tomorrow, all of us, into a world where there's this battle going on for our souls, where there are all these offers and allurements and enticements constantly bombarding us. It's not theoretical what we're receiving here on the Lord's Day. It's not just an interest that we have. This is relevant, it's real, we're in a battle. There are these other alternative perspectives on life constantly hitting us. And so if we're going to be protected from danger, if we're going to be victorious, we need to take on board and heed the teaching that we're constantly receiving. So I'm saying, and this is the context in which the Father's instruction is being delivered. It's not a serene, untroubled context. It's a context where the child will inevitably be bombarded with other influences. And the particular influence then, the particular offer, the particular allurement that features in our passage this evening is, of course, the allurement of easy money. Unjust gain, as it's described in the last verse of our passage, verse 19. In other words, gain at any cost, gain that cares nothing for any ethical principles, gain that is prepared to trample over moral rules in order to get it. That's the kind of offer that the son is being bombarded with here in our passage. And the heart of the offer then is in verses 13 and 14. Here we have then these sinners, as they're described in verse 10, enticing the son, enticing the young person. In this way, we shall find all precious goods. We shall fill our houses with plunder. Throw in your lot among us. We will all have one purse. And it is then an attractive offer that the child, the young person is receiving there from these sinners, as they're described. Not only are there these mouth-watering terms, precious goods, plunder, and by the way, I mean, are any of us totally impervious to such attractions? We all have our own different battles to fight, but is there any one of us who can truly say we've never fantasized about just having all the money in the world to purchase whatever our hearts desire? Or to put the question another way, is the Bible misplacing its emphasis when again and again and again it treats greed and covetousness and the love of money as probably the number one practical issue for the Christian? Surely this is an almost universal battle, isn't it? There is an attractiveness about those terms, precious goods, for all of us. But notice then that alongside those mouth-watering terms. Also in this offer being made to the Son, there are subtle suggestions, aren't there? Subtle suggestions of respectability, for one thing. When the offer says, we shall find all precious goods and we shall fill our houses with plunder. That's interesting. One commentator puts it that that may well imply that they were part of the established society, not brigands living outside of it. These sinners enticing the Son. They're saying, look, we have houses, we're not these kind of outlaws, not these bandits, we're respectable people. And then also the suggestion, secondly, of community. Verse 14, throw in your lot among us, we will all have one purse. And it's kind of the suggestion, perhaps, look, if you join with us, there'll be no repressive hierarchical system like you're presently in. You're presently a son having to submit to your father's instruction. It won't be like that if you join with us. We'll all be equal in our gang. And so it's attractive, this offer of easy money, unjust gain, a quick buck, regardless of ethical principles. It's attractive. And it's in that context then that this father is giving his instruction to his son. So that's the first thing this evening, the context of the father's instruction. But then notice secondly the emphases in the father's instruction. So in this context then, knowing that his son will be enticed and will be allured in this way, knowing that there will be this temptation for his son, how then does the father instruct the son? Well, let's notice three emphases. First of all, prohibition. Verse 15, simply he says, my son, do not walk in the way with them. Hold back your foot from their path. In other words, he's simply saying, don't go there, son. Don't do it. Don't yield. Don't consent. Don't go along with these enticers. Don't touch it. Don't think about it. Stay a million miles from what they're trying to get you to do. Now, we live in a day, don't we, where it's not fashionable to deliver that kind of instruction in any context. Oh, that's dogmatic, that's preachy, that's self-righteous, that's moralistic, that's legalistic. You know the kind of terms that are used of any instruction that seeks to prohibit people from doing anything. But is it not the case that sometimes we need just straightforward prohibition? Don't go there. Don't go there. As young people, from our parents, sometimes we just need the word no. Don't do it. As believers generally, sometimes from the pulpit or from other believers, we just need a don't go there to be said to us. Dale Ralph Davis tells a story from the life of A.W. Tozer. This is what he says. A.W. Tozer tells of a time in his pastorate in Toronto when an attractive young woman made an appointment to see him. She was troubled about a homosexual relationship with her roommate. She was looking for some kind of reassurance. Instead, Tozer faced her squarely and said, young woman, you are guilty of sodomy, and God is not going to give you any approval or comfort until you turn from your known sin and seek his forgiveness. What was her response? I guess I needed to hear that, she admitted. And thereafter, Davis concludes, sometimes we need an ultimatum. And here then, that's the way this father instructs his son. Just don't go there. Don't do it. Perhaps this evening, you're on the brink of going down some path. And you know deep down that the scriptures clearly prohibit it. But your conscience is clever and you can produce self-justifying arguments. Well, it's complex in my particular circumstances. It's more of a grey area in my situation than in a normal situation, and so on. And I'm saying perhaps tonight you just need to hear the prohibition. Don't go there. Don't do it. Will you respond like that woman in Tozer's incident? So that's one emphasis, prohibition. A second emphasis in the Father's instruction, parody. Parody. Because there are kind of two halves, aren't there, to the offer, the enticement that these people are making to the Son. So there's verses 13 and 14 that we've already touched on. That's the second half of the offer. The first half of the offer is in verses 11 and 12. And I suppose the second half of the offer in verses 13 and 14, it's kind of imaginable. You can imagine these people trying to allure the Son in that way. But the first half in verses 11 and 12, it just seems a bit crass, doesn't it? Them saying, come with us, let us lie in wait for blood. Let us ambush the innocent without reason. Like Sheol, let us swallow them alive. I mean, surely no one's going to really try and entice someone to join them in that kind of language. It would be counterproductive. There's something so self-condemning about the language. Come and commit murder with us, basically. Surely these enticers would be much more subtle and indirect than they are being there. But you see, I think the point is that the Father here is using parody in verses 11 and 12, in the first half of the offer. He's suggesting to the Son that's really what they should say. They won't say that. They'll be much more subtle than that, but that's what they should say, because that's really what they're doing. That's the reality. The reality is that they're behaving like that. They won't say it, but that is the reality. And so his point then is that this lifestyle of pursuing easy money, it will hurt other people. It hurts others. He probably doesn't mean that it literally always involves murder, which seems to be the picture he's painting there in verses 11 and 12. He probably doesn't mean that this pursuit of easy money will always involve murder. He's been deliberately hyperbolic, over the top there. But he is saying that it will always leave people exploited and cheated and damaged and impoverished. It will leave a trail of victims in its wake. That kind of lifestyle, it will leave victims in its wake. You see, we talked last week, didn't we, about how Proverbs magnifies the law of Moses. And I think we have a classic example of that here. You see, think of the 8th commandment, do not steal, or the 10th commandment, do not covet. And as we said last week, we can read those commands and think, well, it's not that bad, stealing. It's not that bad, coveting. What's the big deal, really? Aren't those rather draconian rules that God has set? And yet, you see, what this text and many other texts in Proverbs are saying is that actually breaking those commands, it hurts people. It hurts people. If you steal, if you covet, then it will leave other people hurt and damaged. That's what the Father is getting across here. I think as Reformed Christians, we can sometimes be weak on that emphasis. We're very strong on the fact that sin offends God, and of course we must be strong on that. Sin does offend God, and that's the primary issue, I guess, with sin. But the Bible consistently teaches that sin hurts others too. It has horizontal implications as well as vertical ones. And that's what the Father is bringing out here. That if you go along with these people, you will end up hurting poor innocent victims. So there's prohibition and there's parody. But then thirdly, there's prognosis. because the Father also then, in dealing with this temptation, he kind of wants to get the Son to look further down the line, doesn't he, and see where this lifestyle, pursuing easy money, where it leads. And he basically says then that not only does it hurt others, as we've just seen, but actually you end up destroying yourself. If you go down that route, you end up destroying yourself. Verse 19 is a kind of summary verse, isn't it, at the end of the passage. Such are the ways of everyone who is greedy for unjust gain, it takes away the life of its possessors. If you go down that route, you will end up destroying yourself. How then? How does that work? How do those who pursue easy money, unjust gain, how do they end up destroying themselves? Well, in two senses, I think. First of all, in the present. In the present, remember, Jesus talks, doesn't he, in Matthew 6:24 about money as a master. You can't serve two masters, God and money. Money is a master, he says there. It's a slave driver, a slave master, whose demands, if once it possesses you, are total. It will demand more and more of you. It will demand that you discard increasingly your sense of justice and your sense of compassion and your sense of neighborliness and all those other instincts that make you human, that lift you above the level of animals. It will force you to throw those instincts out of the window one by one until all that's left is just this appetite for more, this appetite for stuff, this appetite for possessions. You end up like Gollum in Lord of the Rings, a pathetic creature. It's taken your life. It's destroyed you. You live still, biologically. You breathe. Your body functions, but your life has gone. You're like an animal. In that sense, this pursuit of easy money destroys. It destroys in the present, but then, secondly, it destroys in the future. Because, of course, the whole of the Bible teaches, doesn't it, that there is a final judgment, when God will cast all the unrepentant into hell, which is everlasting death. Not in the sense of being snuffed out, of being annihilated, but in that ultimate sense then, those who go down this route will find their life gone as they suffer everlasting death in that place that God has prepared for his enemies. And so the Father is saying that it's a dangerous, dangerous route to go down, to join with these people who are enticing you. Notice I commented on this earlier in the service, he describes them in verse 15 as having a way. Do not walk in the way with them. And he's saying then that both in its present course and in its final destination, the way of these people is a way of destruction. It's interesting what he says in verse 17. He's basically saying there that these people who live for money, for unjust gain, they're stupider than birds. He's saying that a bird, if it sees a net, it will fly in the opposite direction. But these people, they're actually setting a net for themselves. They're actually destroying themselves. They're digging their own grave. They're destroying themselves in the present and they're destroying themselves in the future. Don't go there, the Father is saying. And how we need, don't we, to see to see sin in its true light, to see what it does to people in the present, what it does to people in the future. And that's what the Father is trying to get the Son to do here. So we've seen then the context of the Father's instruction and the emphases in the Father's instruction. But then thirdly and finally, notice the postscript to the Father's instruction. The postscript to the Father's instruction. Because it's interesting that the Apostle Paul quotes from our passage that we've looked at this evening. He does so in Romans chapter 3, verse 15, and the bit he quotes is verse 16 of our text. Their feet run to evil. And in Romans 3:15, we have their feet are swift to blood. And it's clearly a citation from Proverbs 1. But it's kind of a puzzling use of Proverbs 1 in some ways, because the father then, in Proverbs 1, he's talking, isn't he, about a certain section of humanity, these enticers, these people who have given themselves up to this money-driven lifestyle. They are the ones whose feet run to evil. Whereas Paul now is universalizing this and applying it to everyone, because of course he's building up, isn't he, to his grand conclusion in Romans 3:19, that every mouth must be stopped and the whole world held accountable to God. So whereas the father in Proverbs 1 is saying that there are some people in the world who are like this, whose feet run to evil, and you need to be careful, you need to watch out for them, son, Paul is saying, we're all like this. And we all have these instincts within us, and none of us, therefore, can possibly stand righteous before the throne of God. So that raises the question then, well, is there a discrepancy here? Is Solomon just a bit primitive in his theology, and Paul has to kind of come along and correct him all these hundreds of years later? Well, that, of course, is not the case. The point is, I think, that Paul goes on, doesn't he, from Romans 3:16 and 15 and 19. He's only just begun his argument. He goes further and he shows, doesn't he, as Romans proceeds, he shows that for those who trust in Jesus Christ, although, yes, by nature we do have these instincts, all of us, we have these instincts to defraud others, to rob, to steal, to covet, we all have those instincts, but for those who are trusting in Jesus Christ, then number one, we are made right with God despite having those instincts. And number two, we are actually empowered by God, by His Spirit, to live new lives free from those instincts. And so Proverbs 1, I think, is assuming that. It's assuming the biblical gospel. Solomon, of course, could not have articulated the gospel as Paul would all those hundreds of years later. But Proverbs 1 presupposes the gospel. How is it possible for this family that we're focusing on here in Proverbs 1, how is it possible for this family to not walk in the way of those who rob and defraud and run to commit evil? Well, it's possible through trusting in Jesus Christ and being made right with God and being empowered to live a new kind of life. And although, as I say, Solomon couldn't use the language of trusting in Jesus Christ, he has used the language in verse 7, hasn't he, that we saw last week, of fearing the Lord. And that's the Old Testament equivalent, isn't it? Fearing the Lord, as we said last week, it's not a paranoia, it's a healthy submitting yourself to the Lord. It's the Old Covenant equivalent, surely, of our trusting in Jesus Christ. And it's only then through that, through fearing the Lord, through trusting in Jesus, that it then becomes possible to not follow the way of the wicked. Apart from that, we're all naturally on the way of the wicked. It's only through trusting in Jesus Christ that this teaching about avoiding the way of the wicked assumes any meaning whatsoever. And so really, my basic challenge, as we close this evening, is not actually simply, are you avoiding this lifestyle that is described here so luridly? But there's a more basic challenge, which is this. Are you trusting in Jesus Christ so that it's even possible for you to take on board this instruction and avoid the lifestyle that Solomon's describing? As we said last week, this isn't just a bit of moral advice for anybody. because you can only do something with this if you're trusting in Christ, if you're fearing the Lord. If you're not, then this won't make any sense to you. It won't help you. You won't be able to implement it. Are you trusting in Christ this evening? That's the basic thing. And then if you are, then suddenly you're in a position to take on board this teaching and to make sure that you're avoiding that attractive temptation which all of us will face, to live for money, for wealth, for possessions. Trust in Jesus Christ. Amen.